Good evening, everyone. My name is Jane Blewett, and my presentation tonight, or exchange with you, or conversation, is called Justice for People, Justice for the Earth, Two Sides of the Same Coin. In conversations over these days with you in some groups, I've had a chance to say something about the fact that, you know, I'm here, kind of, because in the last, 15 years of my life, 13 of them I've spent at a National Justice and Peace Center in Washington, D.C., called the Center of Concern. And we were a team of, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people at different times, doing research and consciousness raising, public education, advocacy, retreats, workshops, on the whole question of justice and the injustice in the world, and trying to raise people's consciousness about that, the inequity that exists between the rich countries and the poor countries, between rich and poor people within countries, and what the call that is to us as Christian people. The slogan for the Center of Concern on the stationery, it was written, Center of Concern, : toward a world that is human. And we spent all our time, really, trying to build this more human world. After 13 years there, and through a series of circumstances, my husband and I went to Canada and spent a year at a retreat center called Holy Cross Center on the northern shore of Lake Erie, where the focus of that center was spirituality and ecology, how to bring those two things together. And their stationery had Holy Cross Center, : toward an earth that is community. And I think some of the transition we're in, at least in my own life, and I sense that that's much of our dialogue here, is moving from a focus on toward a world that is human, to toward an earth that is community. A community that includes the human, of course. So when I came back from Canada, I started my own center. I thought, what am I going to do? And so I started my own center, and I call it the Earth Community Center. And I, in my own home, people say, what's the Earth Community Center? I say, it's me, and a file, and a word processor, and a few books, and a growing commitment to give my time and energy towards education about this. But what is a struggle, and it's in our conversations too, is how do we bring together justice for people, justice for the earth? How do we do that? You know, what are some of the aids in that? And the other night also, when we were talking at one point, we were saying, well, if we don't have all our resources in the Bible, where else do we turn? Where can we look for other guidance as we kind of struggle with these issues today? And one thing, I talk out of the Roman Catholic tradition. I've grown up in it, it's my home. And so some of what I say tonight, I'll say Catholic, but I'm sure that it's easily translatable into a much broader, Christian framework, Lutheran framework, but you have to do the translating, I can't. But in our tradition, in addition to the Bible, we do have what we call the tradition. And it includes a whole series of things. And we have a body of books, of statements we call Catholic social teaching. In fact, at the center where I was working, one of the last things we did before I left was put out a little publication, and it's called Our Best Kept Secret, Catholic Social Teaching, because many, many Catholics do not know what this is, Catholic Social Teaching. And when I use that expression, I'm really talking about a body of information that has been gathered over, the past 100 years since Pope Leo XIII in 1891 wrote a very significant document called Rerum Novarum. Often the names are in Latin. But it all of them from that document in 1891, and in another 2 years we'll be celebrating 100 years of this Catholic social teaching. And there's already a lot of celebrations underway and plans to hold seminars and review those 100 years of teaching. But each document that came out was really an effort on the part of church leadership to be in dialogue with, or to do discernment about what was going on in the world around us. In that very first one, in 1891, Leo XIII, the Industrial Revolution had happened. And people had moved from you know, generations of farming, agricultural, rural thinking and living into the cities to start working in factories. And that disruption in economic and social and cultural milieu had tremendous demands on the human person. So this was an effort on the part of leadership to kind of say, well, what does it mean to be a Christian in this urban, kind of industrialized world that's opening up? And each one of the documents along the way have been that, a kind of an effort to be in dialogue. The one that I kind of laugh about today, in 1963, Pope John the 23rd, who became such a loved kind of figure in the whole world, Pope John the 23rd wrote an encyclical called Peace on Earth, Pacem in Terris, which really went far beyond the Catholic community. It was a very important document at that time. But he raised then three signs of the times which we had to grapple with, which he felt the church, the peoples of God, had to be in conversation about. The first one was the rise of the developing nations, third world nation, the early 60s. Frequently, in those years, new nations were being born. And the shape and the color and the description of the United Nations changed overnight as new nations were born. So what did that mean to the world that had been so much in control of the rich north, people of white color and of the rich north? So the emergence of the developing nations, the rise of the laboring class, of working peoples wanting to have their rightful place in the world, and thirdly, the emergence of women. Back in 1963, the call that women around the world were making on the institution. And John the 23rd, Pope John the 23rd was writing that in Rome, and Betty Friedan was in New York writing the Feminine Mystique, which was probably the book that opened, that kind of exploded the whole feminist movement, at least this kind of most recent expression of it. So I often think, I'm sure Pope John and Betty didn't know one another, but from those two very different vantage points, they're addressing very much the same thing. And for me, in the work that I've been doing, I've tried to take some of the basic themes that pervade these documents. If I'm in an audience, I say Catholic social teaching, people kind of they kind of glaze over, you know, these heavy documents, but through them all, they are permeated by certain themes or values or principles that are reaffirmed in each new setting, each new kind of struggle with the times. So I've tried to walk in the door of those themes and demonstrate how, as we have understood them traditionally, they really are not adequate to our times. And yet we use that language, we have to keep pushing them further and further out. So tonight I just want to do that a little bit, walk through a couple of these to demonstrate with you what I mean, and you know why, what the contest is as we're trying to bring together justice for people and justice for the earth. The first one, and again, some of this was very renewed with great vigor at Vatican II. The first one was this whole idea of linking the religious and the social. We use the language of linking faith and justice. That from a time of a lot of dualisms before, an earlier period, we came to understand much more clearly there is no such thing as the sacred and the secular. There is one journey of life. And each step of the way is sacred. So the path that we're on, the way we kind of describe our life, the institutions that we establish, all of that is of a piece. And the challenge falls on us then to make that a whole, that all of it is sacred. And it all becomes kind of a religious task for us. So the language that came out of the church in the modern world was the social, that is, this human construction of the world. And that's what I mean by social. You know, we talk about being social beings. What do we as a species, how do we make our impact on the world? The social, the human construction of the world is not secular in the sense of being outside of God's plan, but is intimately involved with the dynamic of the reign of God. Therefore, faith and justice are necessarily linked closely together. So on those grounds, we said, you know, faith and justice are linked. There is this great bonding of the human with the human. And so much of our energy, Dick, you mentioned it tonight, today, talking about the parish. So much of our energy has been engaged in the human agenda. But I say today, now we are really pushing that understanding to another whole depth, another whole level. It isn't just bonding between the human and the human. The new place we are in today is a bonding between the human and the earth. That is the consciousness that's arising among us. And you know, why now in our time, in very recent times even, this language of creation spirituality? Where did that come from? You know? Somebody didn't just go up in their room and sit down and say, well, I think I'm going to write about the creation. This whole consciousness has been emerging. And creation spirituality is a natural outflowing of the cry that's now going on in the human heart, better understand its link to the earth. And what do we mean by that? What we're saying is that traditionally in our kind of religious expression, our imagination, our services, we have begun pretty much with the redemption, with the Jesus event and the life of Jesus and what happened and how that influences our life. And of course that's important. Of course that's central. But we also have a whole part of us that we have that we say is in the creation. God the Creator. And it is that stream of creation that creation spirituality is trying to raise up. Not to start only with redemption, but to go back to the very beginning. And is that not also sacred? Is that not also a holy time? When we as a kind of a faith body try to do this, though, there are some, Tom Berry talks about, he calls them five transcendences that are in a way, they're hurdles for us in our Western Christian humanist tradition. Hurdles that we have to recognize and break through. And it's not to say any of them are bad, but it is to say that they are now, in the stress that we've given them, they have become dysfunctional. So we are trying to, I just want to walk through those for a moment, and we've already discussed some of them, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. But the very first one that comes forward is this whole thrust that we have had as a Christian tradition on a transcendent God. That the God we have worshipped and spent our time exploring and nurturing our religious imagination is a God who dwells above, a God who is over us, a God who formed a relationship with the people in a covenant, a juridic relationship, a law, and a God who walks with people in history. Over against peoples who understood God as dwelling in the earth, something very sacred in the very earth itself, and the law that bound them to that was a dynamic law, a law that came out of the very workings of the earth itself. And to separate ourselves as a people along that journey from those other pagans, we stress very much this transcendent God. And yes, with you, I want to say very clearly, I worship that God. But today, I know that from the very beginning, I've also claimed a God who's immanent, a God who dwells within. And there is something of this immanence of God which today seems to me calls to us as we look around and realize that all of this, you know, that surrounds us has something of the sacred about it. And yet we have not given that our reverence, because our whole thrust has been on the transcendent God. Also, a second transcendency that's kind of, and again, please hear me, I am not saying we're doing away with the transcendent God, of course not. We're trying in our limited human way to name what is this mystery that none of us can name. But a new way of understanding that God, perhaps today, is a God who also dwells within and makes all of life sacred. A second transcendency that's there and kind of is something we have to work our way through is this whole transcendent human. That we, whether we wanted it or not, whether it was intended, that debate goes on and on, but that the way we have placed ourselves in the historical tradition and on the scale has certainly been on the top. And all the rest has been out there for you and me to do with what we want. I know that when you say that, people say that's a caricature of what's in the book, but if it's a caricature, it certainly is the lived reality that we have come through. We alone image God, all the rest are vestiges. And in saying that, we have put them in a lower place. We have established a hierarchy. And now, you know, when we're kind of looking at that afresh, we're looking around and saying, well, what have we missed along the way? And even, you know, if we go to something as kind of traditional as Thomas Aquinas' Summa, he says in there, that no one creature can adequately give expression to the divine. It takes the whole community. Each has its place in trying to give some idea to us of who the divine is. So we are trying to use a language about this is our community that we have not known before. A third transcendency that we have to kind of break through is this whole question of a transcendent mind. That there's nothing important except the rational, the idea, left brain activity. That's how everything happens. And today, again and again, we're discovering that there is a whole new way of knowing that's only available to us through our right brain. Many of you know about Matthew Fox and his center in California. And I think much of the suspicion about Matthew Fox is that he is deeply committed to both lobes, to learning both left brain and right brain. And therefore, right brain means dreaming, imagination, art, music, dance, and that those forms are our ways of learning, and in fact, we can only learn some things through that medium. They say if we opened the human brain today, the left brain would be this wonderfully convoluted, juicy kind of, you know, element within us, and our right brains would look like a prune. We have not developed this, and so our whole thrust is so much so on a transcendent mind. And in our understanding about that, by mind, we are captured by the definition of all that that came to us through the Enlightenment. You know, in Descartes, the great philosopher of the Enlightenment, whose influence is so heavy in our lives today, his definition of knowledge was what? Power over. Knowledge for the man, for the human, and man, I say that very intentionally. Power was how to control. Power, I mean, and knowledge meant that. knowledge was how do we as humans learn to control nature and use it for our benefit. Not knowledge as understanding about, or knowledge as empathy with, but knowledge as power over. And that kind of stream of the enlightenment continues to haunt us today and control so much. So we're trying to make a breakthrough from left brain to right brain. Not leaving the left brain behind, of course not, but expanding this right brain. And a fourth transcendency that we have to kind of face up to today and work our way through is a transcendent technology. Every species in this whole marvelous, harmonious realm, every species has its own limiter. There is a natural rhythm. You know, the rat has the cat. It fits. Only the human, within the last almost a couple hundred years, through our technology, we have been able to kind of bypass that law, as if we did not have to live in some kind of harmony with it. And now we look around and we are, I think, next to that, the symbol of the Earth from space that has so pervaded our consciousness, that, you know, our blue-green planet hanging in space, one of the other very striking symbols that I think stays in our consciousness is that barge of trash going down the Atlantic or Pacific coast, whatever, it doesn't matter. No, not having a place to dump. We have come to an end point in the way we have tried, that we as a species have lived as if we do not have to abide by by the rhythm of nature. That what we take in, we are responsible for what we put out. And that what we are, you know, that we have to fit into some kind of a rhythm. And today, I think, you know, two things that are happening. Our technology, in a way, we're saying that it makes it possible for us to kind of be outside of those norms of the natural world. But our own consciousness is coming back now to say, that doesn't make sense anymore. That doesn't make sense. If we have no place to place our waste, then we begin to ask about the very beginnings. How do we begin to live in some kind of harmony with this nature? And we are coming all over the world. There isn't a community in this country that isn't beginning at least to have to face the question of recycling. What are we going to do with our waste? And then we get to the question of radioactive waste. Where do we go with that? And so we're thrown back onto our own kind of consciousness about who we are as creatures. Transcendent technology. And the last transcendency I've mentioned is probably one of the most, you know, in a way, kind of the hardest for us to hear. And it's a transcendent goal that within the Judeo-Christian tradition, ours is a historical religion. And deeply embedded in that tradition is the belief, that before the end time, within history, we would come to the land of milk and honey. We would lie down, the lion would lie with the lamb, justice and peace would reign, and that would really happen. And that informed very much, Jerry, the other night you said, you know, that this kind of belief that the end time was going to come very soon, and that would happen before that time. And that drive, that kind of dream of that happening. And in around the 16th, 17th century, when it became apparent that was not going to happen, this whole drive kind of turned itself into a gradual kind of sense of historical progress. Historical progress that could be achieved through science and technological advancement. And so we have this, and that's been fed today by advertising, and we live with the illusion of we can achieve a wonder world. If you buy the right bar of soap, you have it made. You buy the right car, you're on the road. It absorbs us, and we are, none of us now in our lives, you know, it's so hard to find anywhere where people feel satisfied with enough. More and more and more. And that we never have enough. It's got to be bigger. You know, it's got to be better. One channel, now two channels, you know. More. And that's something of this unfulfilled dream that we have channeled into that. So these technologies, you know, are part and parcel. And when we talk about this, it isn't good and bad. It is a system that we have come out of, a belief system deeply embedded in a cosmology that fit the times. And now that is absolutely collapsing on us. On every side. There's struggle, surely, to maintain and say, more technology will get us through. More and more we hear the word appropriate. What is appropriate to a time when we have to accept limitations? And that we as a species live within some kind of expectation of limitation in every arena of our life. If those five are and you knew, it's sort of like when Jerry finished with his design, his charts last night, everyone was kind of like this, and you say, oh my, where do we have some kind of possibilities to look for streams that can open us to new ways? Well, I'd like to just quickly name five also. And again, I'm hoping they're not just in the Roman tradition. You help me with this, but I want to list things that are there for us, that we need to name and draw forth the fruits that are there. First of all, I go back, many Catholics in this country come from Celtic tradition. Come from Ireland. They were the first, that was the first wave of immigrants who came into this country and kind of established many of our traditions here. And if we go back to the earliest Celtic tradition, we find there a people who deeply believed in the spirit and nature. It was a faith, belief that all of nature was sacred. And when the missionaries came to the Celtic peoples, they were encouraged to bring their celebrations, their beliefs into the tradition. And for many years, that was carried forward until it was overwhelmed by a much more Roman mindset. But even today, when it's the Feast of St. Patrick, we joke about, the little people out there, the little people under the, and the leprechauns, that is a definite carry through of a deep belief system. And the earliest woman saint that we bring forward from the Celtic tradition, St. Bridget, they spelled it Bridget, B-R-I-D-G-E-T. There was a goddess, Bridget, B-R-I-G-I-D. And there is great overlapping of what the peoples believed about both of those characters. And the life of Bridget, she was a woman who wanted to give her life to God. She lived, they tell the story, carved out in a cell in an immense oak tree. And she lived her life there, and women gathered around her, and they set up a monastery and started the first religious community. And many scholars now are going back and looking into these Celtic roots to see what we have lost along the way. We go a little bit further into the early 5th century, and we have St. Benedict. And in the Catholic tradition, when something like St. Benedict, he brought a whole religious stream into our church. In the Celtic model, I will call a nature model, Benedict introduced what we call a custodial model. How to care for the land. St. Benedict's, the monasteries were the great gathering centers for peoples who came from miles around to learn how to farm, to learn how to grow herbs that were medicinally, that could heal. These were the great learning centers. And today we're saying to Benedictine priests and sisters who have monasteries still, you must be the new centers where people come to learn about solar power, where people come to learn about alternative agriculture, where people come to learn how to live low on the food chain. All kinds of possibilities that you be examples for, and that we learn from you. We move on a little bit into the Middle Ages, and today we have a whole stream of mystics. Hildegard of Bingen is one who comes to, is sort of the most well-known. Her music the other night during the vigil service, the Gregorian chant, that was Hildegard of Bingen's music. This woman lived to be 80 years old, a musician, author, poetess, prophet, a theologian. She went about the countryside teaching. The monasteries wanted her because she went to the men. She outlived 12 popes. She was a tremendous woman of the Middle Ages. And she talked about her great gift was this sense of God's fertility, the greening power of God. She talked about, she used the expression, the greening power of the earth is the pattern for all goodness. The fact that each spring that grass grows green, that for her, that greening and juiciness and the fertility of God was a very real expression that was there. So in Hildegard, she's called the grandmother of the ecological age. Her name, there's a wonderful new book, a new biography of her called Sister of Wisdom by Barbara Newman. If any of you want to read A Good Life of Hildegard. The year she died, Francis of Assisi was born. And with St. Francis, we have this fraternal model. You know, again, it sounds sort of romantic to us, brother, sun, sister, moon, the stars, the birds, the bees. Francis believed in that community, and he lived among that community. And we have in St. Francis a fraternal model. And again, in the church today, we're turning to Franciscans, sisters and priests, and saying to them, you are not being faithful to your charism. If you do not bring into the community at large today the gift that St. Francis is, and the insights that he carried about this immense community of life to which we belong. Lastly, the last kind of resource that I think, and it's probably the one that is most timely for us, because he's a man of our own times, the insights, the evolutionary model of Pierre de Chardin, Teilhard. Teilhard lived a Jesuit priest with a deep religious sense of life, of meaning, of God, a deeply holy man. He was a paleontologist with impeccable scientific credentials. He combined those two things in his life. He lived in China. He did diggings in China for many years. He was banished, actually, to China by his community because he was too radical. He died in 1955. He's almost a contemporary of ours, Chardin. But his key insight, the core of Chardin's contribution, was his understanding and his teaching that the journey of the universe that began 15 billion years ago to our best understanding today, that journey began with the spark of life was not only a physical event. It was not only gases and hydrogen and helium and carbon and complexities and rocks. And that was not just physical, but it was psychic from the very beginning. A spirituality, an interiority on that path. So that we today, we were there, and our consciousness is a fruition of what has gone on over those 15 billion years. We have come out of the earth, and what we have today could not be if it were not there from the very beginning. So this immense kind of thread that ties us to all of creation, not that we are separate from it, not that we are above it, but we have come out of it. We are part and parcel of that creation. The universe, the earth, 5 billion years ago, consciousness, life, human, one single journey, one single story. And today, we look around us and say, this is our new story. This is what we're trying to open up. the journey of the universe, the place that the human has in this immense community of life, and the very fact that today we're looking at this fragile blue-green planet and learning more and more that it is alive itself. Now, it seems to me that those learnings raise deep religious questions for us that we haven't even begun to explore. And what I say we need more than anything else today is not perhaps more facts as much as it is how to free our religious imagination so that we can take in this reality and live with it and explore it and taste it and nurture our religious life with it. That we say, who is this Creator God? One just simple example, up at this retreat center where we spent a year, you know, in the Catholic Church, we have in all our churches, we have stations of the cross, we call them, and they follow the journey of Jesus from the agony in the garden through to the crucifixion. And we walk that journey, and, you know, that's very much a part of our kind of religious imagination. Up at Holy Cross, they had, this was a piece of property, it was 50 acres, right on the shore of Lake Erie. And they had on the grounds 8 stations of the cosmic earth. And they were physical settings. The first one, it was the first station was the emergence of the universe. And it was an immense big platform that was built out so that you had only the lake and the horizon to see. And people were encouraged to go there and just be there and enter into the mystery of the origins of the universe. Do yoga. Sing. Write your poetry. Do what you need. But make that somehow inside you. The emergence of water. I think today, as a faith tradition, if we have to look at our sacraments. We've been saying that. How do you... But you know, in our church, the first thing we do at baptism is bless the water and then pour it over the child. I say that water is blessed in its very being. Long before we ever came along, that water was there, and we came out of it. You know, we should acknowledge the blessedness that water is. Yes, perhaps we bring one more, we bring another dimension to it. But first of all, our first gesture is not to bless the water, but to acknowledge the blessedness of the water. And let it pour itself over us and let us stand drenched in the blessedness of the water. And I think, you know, we have to look at our sacraments, all of them, in the light of all these very elements, the bread and the wine. Can we celebrate Eucharist if the earth is denuded of any kind of vitality? The bread is supposed to be the bread of life. If the wheat is poisoned, if the soil is poisoned, we can't have a Eucharist. We can't be people, we can't be religious people, unless the earth is sacred and clean and pure with us. It has to walk, we have to walk in the journey of the earth. And if we do not walk that, we cannot claim to be a sacred people. We have no right to that. And we need a new creed. It isn't enough to say, I believe in God, creator of heaven and earth. What does that mean? We have to open that out. We have a long story about Jesus, and I delight in that, and I'm grateful for that. We have a good bit of theology about the Spirit, but we have hardly anything about this God who creates. In Jorgen Moltmann's new book, not so new, a few years old now, called God in Creation, he talks about how our language would change even if we talked about an immanent God. We wouldn't use words so much like making, preserving, maintaining, perfecting. He says those are verbs that apply to a one relationship, a God who is the cause of this. But if you say a God dwells with, then the language we would use would be a God who indwells, a God who sympathizes with, participating in, accompanying, enduring, delighting, glorifying. The very language we would use about God would change. And we can go on and on, you know, to try and
open ourselves to how our own reality, our own sense of who we are, what it is to be human, what it is to be Christian, what it means for us. And the three basic laws that pervade the whole of creation from the very beginning, the law of differentiation, that everything is different. Nothing is the same. The law of interiority, that each differentiated particle, that from that first atom, to the all the differences that we see in the eye, each differentiated particle has its own interiority, has its own sacred innerness. And thirdly, that all of that lives together in communion. Differentiation, interiority, and communion binds us all together. And perhaps that's the new cosmological model of the Trinity. Differentiation, interiority, and communion.
Question about, can you say a little more about interiority? I'm intrigued by that, but I don't, do you mean like consciousness?
Yeah,
or,
a way of consciousness. And you know what, one of the examples, I said it to some people the other day, one thing that just like delights me, and I think it's what we, you know, what we're struggling to, I read of an experiment that the scientists were trying to find out how far bees would go to collect nectar for the hive. So they had a control group of bees, and they had a dish of sugar water. And they put the sugar water a certain distance the first day, and the bees went and they came back to the hive. And they moved it the same distance the second day, and they went and came back. And the third day, and the fourth day, always the same distance, they kept moving it. On the fifth day, on the sixth day, when they went to put the bowl down, the bees were already there. And it is, you know, I say there is a consciousness, there is a way of knowing within that community that we are just beginning to understand. And there is something, and so when you say, you know, when Tom Berry says, and I said that today, you know, the task to reinvent the human at the species level, I really do mean that we have to learn to be another kind of species among other species, to try and learn. And that may sound romantic, but I do not believe it is. We stand before the mystery of life that is all around us. And in the past, we have presumed evidence around us is, the evidence is there. The Great Lakes, when the native peoples came upon that water, they called it the Sweet Water. That was the name the native peoples gave to the Great Lakes. No one would call the Great Lakes Sweet Waters today. Are we stewards? Is that the language, or is there a posture of humility that we have to adapt as a species before this mystery of life of which we are just learning how much we are? The interiority, to my mind, is something like consciousness. Some of the other, you know, the themes, I just got, that was just the first, linking faith and justice. I was trying to take off from that, but some of the other ones that, you know, you would recognize, that the dignity of the human person, all our Catholic social teaching is based on the dignity of the human person. You know, that we recognize every person has that dignity. In saying that, yes, of course, but what about the dignity of the rest of creation? We've kind of, the focus, the emphasis is here, and we just have neglected this. And when, as soon as we talk about the dignity of the human person, we move to the language of rights. Humans have rights, political, civil rights, and socioeconomic rights. And we use that language. Mm-hmm. Now the United Nations has developed, out of the UN, 1982, a charter for nature, with the whole language of rights of nature. Nature has rights. Those trees have rights in their own integrity.
I think that's another terminology, or other terminology they use too, is a consistent ethic.
Consistent ethic.
I mean, are you consistent when you hold human life sacred and you don't hold the rest of them sacred?
Right.
Is there an inconsistency there?
But in saying that, then, I also would, you know, what we learn as we look at the story, though, is that in the rhythm, from the very beginning, life and death are part of the journey. Huh? And all along the way, members of the community giving their life for the life of the community. So it isn't, there are trade-offs. There is a life and death. We eat, we take from other creatures, as they do. But it's done for so that life might go on. It's a creative act. That's what I call it, creative violence. There's a certain violence in nature. There's no doubt about it. But it is not the violence of Saturday Night Specials. It is not the violence of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. It is a violence. It is a creative violence that new life might come forth. Someone mentioned tonight about the fire in Yellowstone. Now what are they finding? Certain species of plants, it would only break through their casings in the heat of fire, are coming to new vitality, are being born in forms. You know? That there is a rhythm and a pattern. And much of it is, the problem too is it's in a geological time frame. We make decisions in our very limited time frame. We try to do it within the best judgments that we have. But if we can even cast our decisions, but the Native people say they make their decisions in the light of the seventh generation, the language they use. What will this decision today mean for seven generations? That's a wisdom we can learn from. In fact, if we don't learn it, I think they have a wisdom that is critical to take us into the future.
I know when you were talking, I was thinking the elementary was saying that Alaskan English, Eskimo, and I hope that in our leveling of equality with nature, that if we put down nature and animals, that we will not lower ourselves down to where we put them, perhaps with science and things, but raise nature and animals up to where we are with that and retain that dignity. As I guess I saw a lot in stories that they studied about the respect and the dignity that they showed to the animals that they needed to care to eat and so on. Or maybe then to make ourselves better, we segregated everything else and we need not to love ourselves.
Yeah, you read the letter of Chief Seattle, and you just, you know, you sit in front of that and just say, that's a wisdom, you know, far beyond where we are, a kind of relationality that,
This past summer, just timing with the Native Americans and the sacredness that they have to teach us about. I remember attending a conference, or it was there, the gathering of Native Americans in Wisconsin, and they talked of their tradition of how every time they cut down a tree, or any time they picked a plant for medicinal purposes, they would offer, they used tobacco, and offer that, they'd put it on the ground where they took of the tree or the plant, an offer of thanks. And there are still a few people that practice that today. It ties in. They realize that with the sacredness, you still need to take plants